Hello, it's Wednesday 29th of September. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowman of Check In Asia and I are delighted to welcome back Mayur Mak Patel, Regional Sales Director at OAG, to discuss all things airlines, airports and aviation in ASEAN. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello wherever you are in the world and thanks for listening in. So on today's show, we'll be chatting again with Singapore-based aviation expert Mayur Mak Patel, who is Regional Sales Director of OAG. We'll be discussing the year so far and the outlook for the skies above us in the final quarter of 2021 and into 2022. Mak was last on the show back in May 2020, so there's plenty to catch up on. So Mak, many thanks for coming back onto the show. How are you doing today and how's daily life in Singapore right now?
Yeah, great to be back, Gary and Hannah. Life in Singapore is a bit of a mixed bag. We just went through a soft lockdown, what they call stabilization, due to increase in cases. So today we had 2,236 new cases in Singapore. It's probably one of the highest since pandemic. So a bit of a mixed bag, but I think with current measures that the government's taking, hopefully things will stabilize and life will get back to normal in a month or so.
Yeah, fingers crossed for that. You have the benefit of a pretty high vaccination rate as well, Mak. So we've got plenty to catch up with and we've got plenty to pack into the next 30 minutes. So let's get started and let's start in Singapore because, you know, the current aviation landscape has changed considerably over the last 18 months. But we're hearing that Changi Airport is starting to get a little bit busier. The two vaccinated travel lanes are now up and running. What's the current feeling and what's the sort of outlook at the moment in Singapore aviation?
Oh, so if we go back to January last year, just before the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, Changi Airport was ninth largest airport in the world, based on number of seats airlines were flying to and from. That slipped to about 134th position, where Changi was linked to a total of 173 cities as at December 2019. But the number has now dropped to 97. So you can see the magnitude of change. And only 64 airlines were operating at the airport as of first week of September, down from 91. Falling such a long way is obviously significant, but it has to be placed in the context of a global pandemic, during which international travel has been severely restricted, allowing the list of the largest airports to be dominated by those that have large domestic networks. In the meantime, you can see that Singapore Airlines is expected to reach 33% of its scheduled passenger capacity relative to before the pandemic by October, but it's carrying only 4% of its pre-COVID traffic. So, but in the long term, airlines like Singapore Airlines have strong shareholder support and is well positioned for recovery through its segment diversification and coordination with like-minded industry stakeholders. And we'll also see low-cost carriers in Singapore as well as in Asia Pacific recover faster when borders are open across the region. And as you said earlier, Singapore has also started vaccinated travel lane to Germany, and they're in current discussions with other like-minded destinations where vaccination rates are equivalent or to that levels that other countries have been able to achieve to date. So we'll probably see gradual reopening in months to come. How quickly Changi hub status is re-established is really a function of borders reopening, which is really not in Singapore's control, as it takes two to tango for the other side to open up before Singapore can also open up to other destinations. So again, the real crux of the issue is that it takes both markets to open up before you see any significant movement in passenger volumes moving to and from.
Mak, that's a great intro into what's actually happening there in Singapore. Let's broaden it out just a little bit again so we can look back over what's happened. Now, we spoke for my newsletter a year ago, September 2020, and you said, and I quote, "Some airlines are probably going back 20 or 25 years in terms of growth, so they will have to readjust their network. some of the older and larger aircraft will be retired, and there will be a further reduction in staff numbers. Airlines usually operate through their cash flow, and when that isn't being generated, you have huge costs and need shareholder support. There's no other way out. How do you reflect on that comment 1 year later? Because it seems still very relevant.
Yeah, the statement is still valid. And if you look at international capacity, it's somehow recovered gradually, but it's still at levels seen in 2004. So that's about 17 years ago now. So that's going to take a very slow ride into the recovery phase. But the differential throughout COVID has been twofold. Firstly, stakeholder support from governments, shareholders, and through lending has been incredible, with everyone realizing that this has been an industry issue rather than a case of bad management by one particular carrier. Secondly, aircraft lessors have also been very supportive, in part because they had limited other clients seeking new aircraft or existing aircraft, and also because at the end of the day, they accepted that they will get paid. Calling in bad debts would eventually be a worse position than allowing the carriers to defer and reschedule payments. So for airlines, the issue is now going to be about demonstrating that they can rebuild cash reserves and cash flow whilst being profitable, and that is where good management will be crucial moving through the recovery phase. Large airlines have shifted their focus on maximizing cargo capacity, including improving utilization of their freighters, operating cargo-only passenger flights, and converting passenger aircraft into freighters. So that's basically your passenger aircraft turned into a freighter, where they take aircraft seat out and they put dry cargo goods on the passenger cabin. So as a result of that, cargo yields and load factor have remained very strong. So just to put some perspective into the cargo operations during COVID period, airlines have been able to recover a lot of cash from their operations, despite passenger aircraft being grounded. So they've been able to maximize the utilization of their cargo fleet, adding additional passenger aircraft. And you've seen a huge increase in cargo yields that has been able to compensate some of the lost passenger revenue in the system. A full recovery in capacity is unlikely before 2023, and full demand recovery probably 2024, assuming there's no any further disruption with hard lockdowns or sudden shifts in government policies and so forth.
So, I mean, despite this obviously being a really difficult past 18 months, it's interesting because we haven't seen that many airline closures or consolidations in the region. What are the reasons for this? Is this down to cargo? Are there other reasons? And could we see either of these happen in the near future?
Yeah, so we've seen strong government support, which has stopped some airlines from going bankrupt. Without government intervention support, we probably would have seen massive bankruptcies in the first 6 months of this crisis. And if you look at some of the carriers that airlines that are owned in this part of the region, it's mainly government-backed. And airlines usually represent the backbone to economic activities. So keeping them up and running is very crucial to the entire economy, as well as maintaining links with other countries around the world for commerce and business activities, as well as moving goods and services around the world. So that's been a crucial factor in terms of why governments have stepped in. On the other hand, we've seen mergers between Asiana Airlines and Korean Air to save the Korean aviation industry. So they've got a lot of stakeholding between various industries in Korea that's directly linked to the aviation, whether it's manufacturing, cargo systems, network connectivity, and so forth. So having a strong aviation industry is quite crucial for the Korean economy. Then we saw ownership change in Australia through a bankruptcy of Virgin Australia. So that went through a voluntary administration with a new owner coming in. And they've restructured their business model to become a value-based airline, along with sharper focus on the Australian domestic network, rather than having a very mixed approach that they did previously. And more recently, if you look at Southeast Asia, Philippine Airlines filed for bankruptcy in the United States to slash $2 billion in debt as it tries to survive the pandemic. So the national carrier of Philippines said in the filing that it will allow it to restructure contracts and cut debt by at least $2 billion whilst getting $655 million in fresh capital when it emerges from the Chapter 11 process from the US bankruptcy court. So you've got different variation of bankruptcy protection, ownership change, and mergers and acquisition that's been going through in this region in the last 18 months as a result of the pandemic.
And quite a number of these airlines in the region have also been selling off planes and not renewing their leases. Do you see this slimmed down fleet being just a short-term measure, or is this going to be a trend for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, the industry is resetting, and after it has reset, then we can expect a rebuild. So it's one step at a time. So I think that will allow the industry to sort of focus on where it needs to recover, pull out some of that excess cost out of their system in order to bring some of the cash burn rates down whilst maintaining a level of fleet strategy in place to take good foothold in the recovery phase. At the moment, fleet downsizing is in line with demand and maximizing utilization. Some airlines are impairing their fleet as some of the aircraft are unlikely to re-enter meaningful economic service before they retire or are returned to lessors. I think there will be expansion and it will come perhaps quicker than people may expect. And that could be in different phases. It's not going to be a smooth recovery. You will get bumps along the road. The market conditions pre-COVID were positive in nearly every instances, and fundamentals have not really changed. So there's a lot of pent-up demand. There's going to be revenge travel. People would like to go out, experience different cultures, different environment from their current domicile, and just to get away from the hectic lifestyle that they've led for the last 18 months. So what we need to address is the freedom to travel and the risk of sudden and sharp lockdowns like we have seen in many parts of the world, as well as part of Asia Pacific region, where lockdown has been prolonged in many countries to date. They're not helping consumer confidence at all, however necessary they may appear. COVID-19 is a virus that does not have a passport or respect border control requirements, and we all have to learn to live and accept it.
Yeah, there was some. I detected some cautious optimism there, Mac, but obviously a great deal of realism. We're still in a very difficult situation. Here in Southeast Asia at the moment, obviously the talk is awash with reopenings and governments, tourism boards are looking at new ways that they can partially reopen inbound travel at least. We hear talk about sandboxes and vaccinated travel lanes. But at the moment, things are still pretty unclear. And these openings are still very limited. So I guess at the moment, it's pretty difficult for airlines to plan. You know, what's the potential outcome of this for airlines? Because it's not really helping them look longer term, is it?
No. So one example is the Phuket sandbox scheme for COVID-19, which hasn't been quite the resounding success as expected. The Tourism Authority of Thailand recently said they only had 26,400 foreigners that have landed in Phuket since the sandbox scheme was launched on 1st July. And it was actually targeted to attract about 100,000 tourists in the third quarter. But judging by the number of arrivals in July and August, the target may be impossible to achieve. But it's a step in the right direction. So a lot of the destinations are planning different phased approach to reopening. And it's just to bring local confidence back into the market and also to do a bit of trial and error in terms of trying to test how big the market would be and how long the tourists would be able to stay in a particular destination when they come far abroad to experience the cultural experiences and just trying to get away, escape the hustle and bustle of COVID restrictions. So average tourist in Phuket was spending somewhere around 11 to 12 days on average before flying back home. So you could see that people are trying to get away for a much longer period now. And just to sort of wind down and de-stress from all this hassle that they've gone through in the last 18 months. And if you look at Southeast Asian destinations such as Thailand, it's very reliant on China for reopening, for any significant growth. But as you know, China is actually restricting a lot of their outbound travelers based on their zero COVID strategy. Destinations like Thailand would need to look elsewhere, places like Western Europe and Russia, as the source market, as neighboring countries remains closed. And airlines have to really rebalance their network structures because the traditional way of flying people around is no longer valid. So you've got to look at new markets, new schedules, different types of frequencies, and so forth. So it's taking a lot of different views and different outcomes from different stakeholders to get this right, and looking at the broader and bigger picture when it comes to recovery, because it will be roadblocks along the way, and you've got to think differently, think outside the box, and be very creative in your approach.
Absolutely. I mean, and like you were saying, it's such an uncertain situation right now for airlines to be operating in, you know, just planning where to fly to, their capacity, how often they should fly, how many staff they need. It's going to be really, really challenging, not only for the rest of 2021, but going into 2022 as well. How do you see Southeast Asian airlines kind of approaching those challenges? You know, are some perhaps more successful at this than others?
Planning will be flexible. So we've already seen airlines making between 10 to 20 times more scheduled changes than they did 2 years ago, as they work out how demand is shaping and how restrictions are being applied. Travels will also have to be more flexible and sympathetic when schedules get adjusted at the last minute, as we have perhaps be we have to be accepting of the difficulties airlines and all members of the travel ecosystem will face in the build out phases of the recovery rather than criticize the action. So I think it's going to be very important for airlines to look at their schedules on an ongoing basis to really work out where the demand exists and where the attractions will be from a consumer point of view. So if you look at Maldives reopening, airlines will be looking at different ways of moving people there. And another example that was very interesting was Finnair. So Finnair generally has been expanding in the Asia Pacific market for the last 5 years, but they'll be starting a 3-weekly services to Dubai, because Dubai, as you know, have reopened, and a lot of Europeans are actually going into Dubai for the World Expo, just a different experience, a hot weather, sun, sand experience, and basically pure relaxation just to get COVID out of their minds. So airlines are, again, restructuring their network to look at new opportunities, new destination, and there will be some shift in their focus for the temporary period whilst borders open and government policies tend to be a bit more favorable for the rest of the world. So pre-COVID, we did see this analogy of domestic, regional, long-haul recovery. But if you look at the way things are turning out, it's generally basically vaccinated travel lanes that could be a long-haul sector. It doesn't necessarily mean people will travel short trips to destinations that are 3 or 4 hours away, because there might be some constraint in terms of border closures. So they would go all the way up to Europe just to have some vacation and time out from their normal domicile that they've been surrounded for in the past 18 months. So very dynamic, things are changing very fast. And I think a lot of those industry stakeholders will need to take that into account when they're looking at different scenarios for their planning, looking at where they need to add capacity as well as growing their business in the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, like you said, Max, so many schedule changes, so much uncertainty at the moment. But I guess at the moment, the big elephant in the airport lounge is digital health passports. We still have no clear agreement on that in ASEAN. And obviously, that's making everything difficult for the airlines, but the entire travel industry. Now, what do you think is the current situation on that? And how would it help airlines to have a more clearer framework on vaccine passports?
So health passports are the only way forward. Clear evidence of vaccination and the necessary testing protocols are the only way that we can rebuild confidence across countries. And because each and every country will have their standards, so there needs to be a unified scheme where it needs to be recognized that this person has been vaccinated and they're ready to go, and for the other country to recognize that particular certification. So I think a common standard health passport is probably the way forward in terms of the way authorities would recognize and allow people in and out. I recall back in the 80s, we used to carry that yellow WHO booklet for vaccines. And that was the standard that was prescribed, that if you went to certain countries out there, you would need to get a yellow fever jab. And the doctor would actually certify that, and you would present that at the check-in when you board the flight. And that's what was acceptable at that time. That was the protocol. So now we've got different standards. Each country will probably have their own undertaking or certification that they will recognize. So IATA Travel Pass is one of them. And there's Common Pass as well that's done through World Economic Forum. So these are some initiatives that airlines will need to adopt in terms of working through how the passengers will travel to and from, and whether it's an authentic certification that people have taken the vaccines and a proof of record.
So things like vaccine certificates, obviously a major concern, I would guess, for airlines right now in terms of being able to ramp back up demand. What would you say are some of the other major concerns in the aviation market right now?
I think getting the supply and demand correct in order and being able to operate profitably through some of the services that's open out there. And also cargo in the mix is very crucial. So a lot of the flights that are actually flying around the world at the moment, when you open up an app to see where aircraft are, the positioning of them, you probably note that load factors for some of these airlines are anywhere from 13 to 20% at maximum. So I think the biggest worry for the airlines is to sort of bring down their cash burn rate and look at new opportunities where they can operate profitably, and looking at cost very carefully in terms of how they recover through the crisis. And as you know, airlines have a bunch of leased aircraft. There are some ownership. You have to look at the cash reserve. You've got to look at shareholder support down the track, whether they can survive the next 6 to 12 months out, whether business travel will recover, because that's kind of a large portion of the revenue that airlines generate from business travel in premium cabin. Will that come back? And then some people are saying, well, in the last 18 months, we've been used to taking Zoom or Teams calls. So what impact will that have? Will a portion of the business travel never recover? So that's a crucial question that airlines would need to ask and modify their services or frequency to different destinations accordingly. So a lot of that is up in the air. Aircraft reconfiguration. So you've got to look at premium to leisure passenger mix. How do you sort of change your mixes around fare families? How the airfares are operated? What sort of bundling offering do you provide to business travelers or leisure travelers? So it's a very segmented approach. LCC is the other bit. Will that grow faster than full service? It all depends on the way the markets will open up. So there's a lot of consideration for a lot of the airlines out there in looking at recovery. What does that look like? So I've known a lot of network planners out there that have done something like 100 plans since COVID started. And some of them have actually said that they've stopped looking at that and they're just focusing on the next 4 to 6 weeks just to see how things will pan out. So there's no point in doing 6 to 12 months plan because there's so much changes that are happening. So if you look at Maslow's law of hierarchy of needs, right? So you're trying to fulfill your basic needs. So travel will probably come somewhere in between. So after you've got your shelter, your food, and a lot of people say Wi-Fi is one of the high needs nowadays. But if you look at travel, it will sort of come down. It won't be as a high priority basic need that people will have to fulfill because a lot of people have lost their jobs, they're repairing their bank accounts. So travel will take some time to recover. And then when it does recover, what sort of segmented approach do you take? Are they high yielders that will come back, or will they be very price conscious, sensitive travelers that will be returning? So you've got to cater to those type of groups of people.
Certainly a great deal of complexities are up ahead, Matt. You touched there on LCC operations, also the legacy carriers. What about new airlines? Are we likely to see any more new airlines emerging? We've seen one or two in Hong Kong, for example. But do you think that's going to be something that the landscape will have to deal with in the next couple of years?
Oh, yeah, sure, Gary. So the current crisis has allowed new entrants to sort of look at the industry and say, look, there's a lot of employees that are on furlough or they've lost their jobs. So you can get a really good labor cost from recruitment. And again, it depends on the business model that these new airlines are starting up. So aircraft lease rates have come down, ownership costs are coming down. And more importantly, airports are also looking at starting new destination where they've lost ground in the last 18 months. So they're welcoming new carriers to sort of have a chat with them and see how they can actually introduce that to new slots at particular airports. So in Southeast Asia, we've seen one Indonesian airline, Super Airjet, backed by Lion Air's co-founder, Rushdi Kirana. He's also betting on the millennials and post-COVID travel bounds and to compete with Indonesia AirAsia and CityLink. So there's a new carrier within Indonesia that's going to be attracting millennials. So that's the core segment market that they're going after. In other parts of the region, India has also become a hotspot for new carrier startup. So there's an airline called Akasa Air, which is planning to launch a new ultra low cost carrier with up to 70 aircraft. And then you've got the Jet Airways revival being planned and shifting their head office to New Delhi. So they're looking at making a comeback. We have seen some market opportunities. You will see a bit of mergers and acquisition with Air India being privatized from government side of the business. So you'll probably see the Tatas take a huge chunk in Air India, which throws another question as to how they will integrate their stakeholding with Vistara and AirAsia. So they've got a full service airline on one spectrum, and they also got a low cost on the other spectrum. And how does that play out with merging Air India into that whole portfolio? And then the other question is, what happens to Singapore Airlines' 49% in Vistara? How would that play out with this M&A activity that Tata's planning to acquire the national carrier? Across in North Asia, you've got Greater Bay Airlines from Hong Kong, which is facing regulatory hurdles with an inquiry set for late December. So they recently took delivery of their first aircraft, but they were not able to conduct a symbolic flight to Beijing on National Day because they're awaiting their fate of its operating license from the Air Transport Licensing Authority. So a bit of a hurdle for them to catch up on, but they also saw a need for a low-cost carrier model serving Hong Kong to secondary and primary cities in China and other points in Southeast Asia. But as you know, there's a lot of regulatory hurdles in Hong Kong because you've got established carriers there, and they'll be protecting their turf as they recover through the COVID crisis. So the last thing that you probably need is another carrier starting up. But as you know, it's a free market. Competition is always good. But it will be very interesting to see how that sort of progresses through and how they sort of inflict on their position as a low-cost carrier, because you've got Hong Kong Express to compete against. And there's a lot of congestion already, as you know, in Hong Kong just before COVID started. So recovery in Hong Kong will be quite an interesting element to sort of track because of their hub status, just like Singapore. They'll be probably making some plans to have a fast recovery with the mainland Chinese market as that opens up with Hong Kong and Macau.
Lots going on everywhere. So it's not that airlines are sitting back and waiting for things, but forging ahead and seeing that business opportunity. So a couple more questions for you, Matt, before we wrap up. So when borders do start to reopen in Southeast Asia, do you see regional air travel mostly focusing on primary airports? What's going to happen to these secondary and tertiary airports that were starting to come up before the pandemic?
Yeah, so the vaccinated travel lanes for specific point-to-point markets will kickstart the reopening, especially for markets such as Singapore and Hong Kong, where they don't have domestic market. So there will be flights that will go mainly point-to-point into primary airports. And then you've got secondary and tertiary airports where you've got a large domestic base. So if you look at Malaysia, there's a lot of secondary, tertiary airports in the domestic vicinity. Indonesia's got that. Japan is the other one. And of course, China has plenty of those. So they will recover at a much faster rate because governments are promoting domestic tourism. And obviously, you don't need to show vaccine passports and so forth in domestic travel. So you will probably show a proof of vaccination, but not to the format for international where you'll be doing the swab test and so forth, which becomes very costly as a proposition. I think domestic will see a large growth into the primary, secondary and tertiary airports. And of course, cost will be an important element when airlines are looking at the pent-up demand, and they'll need to closely align capacity to demand because you've got fuel prices that are increasing. It's about something like nearly $80 per barrel. So that adds to the complexity of airlines' operating cost, especially when you don't have significant premium revenue to support that. So airlines will be very careful in terms of how they kickstart some of this secondary or primary services initially until there's a demand that they feel comfortable with and they can get a good hold of the market before they expand that further.
Makes sense. And so, personal question for you now, Mac. We love to ask this to our guests, and obviously you've been in Singapore, so really very limited places to go since the pandemic hit. What are your likely travel plans in the near future? Do you think you'll be going overseas this year?
Not this year. I would love to go back to Australia, but Australia has this awful capacity control, which can be something like 10 or 15 passengers per flight. So it's very hard to get into Australia. Then you've got this quarantine regime, which is not sustainable. So I'll skip that. So having those type of restriction really puts a dampener when you're willing to go back and see your family members and so forth. But one of the top picks that I would do if things really open up is to head up to Japan. I've got an office and sales team there, so I'd like to first see them. And I also like to see my Japanese customers because FaceTime is very important. Having that taken out in the last 18, 19 months when I went there last just seems a bit too long. For the meantime, we are relying on Zoom calls, Teams call, just to reconnect with our customers. But FaceTime doesn't really, you can't beat FaceTime. And I think that's the most important and critical part to doing business in this region. So Japan would be my sort of hot pick.
I think I have to agree with you, Mac. I think Australia and Japan will certainly be high on my list when we can eventually take to the skies again. So, Mac, thanks very much for being on the show. Thanks so much for your insights. It's great. We've covered a huge amount of ground there. Thanks again. And that brings us to the end of today's Aviation and Airlines special edition of the show. We hope that you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and your comments on what we discussed with Mac or anything that we missed out. Drop us an email at hello@seasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or on Twitter, SEA Travel Show.
Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Overcast, Podcast Addict, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each one. And don't forget, if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, give us a review because that helps other people find the show.
So thanks again to Mac, and that's almost a wrap for today. But Hannah, before we go, we've got some news to tell because you're going to be taking a little break from the show. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, I am. That's right, Gary. So after slogging away on pandemic-related tourism news for the last 18 months, I need a little break. So I will be taking some extended leave away from the podcast until the new year. So you'll be flying solo, Gary. I'm looking forward to listening. Let's hope that when I come back to the show in January, it's going to be a whole new open Southeast Asian tourism world, though I do have my doubts.
We wish Hannah all the very best for the next few months. Hopefully she'll be popping back and forth before the new year. But the show will go on, and we'll be back next week with some new guests and some new stories. So I look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism with you again very soon.